So having said all that, over to you, Louisa, take it away.
Okay, sounds great. So thanks all for joining today. The second slide, slide number two in my stack, has a brief outline. The first thing is the link to the Sophia Science Archive itself. And what I'll do at the very beginning of my talk is, especially if you're a current or recent Sophia observer and you just want your data, I'm going to give you a quick launch, right? A way to get into that really quick. And then I'll go through more slowly, showing more about the details that you can change, right? You can look for moving or inertial targets, and there's all sorts of other choices I'll go through more slowly. And then near the end, I'll go through some, just a few highlights from other IRSA tools that have the same look and feel so that you can, for example, plan future observations. And then the very last slide has a collection of pointers to where to get more help, including the online help, the IRSA help desk, and the IRSA YouTube feed. So slide three is just a heading for the fact that we're going into the quick start guide. Slide four is for you if you just want your data, right? These are the main steps you need to do. Especially if your data is still proprietary, you need to log in. So that means you need to contact the Sophia Science Center to request access. Or if you are not the PI of a project, if you're a postdoc working with a PI, you need to get your PI to email the project and request access for you. Then you need to load the Sophia Science Archive. Then you search on the PI name, you select all the data, and you download. It's not too hard. I'll go through it briefly next. So slide five is just a screen snapshot of the IRSA homepage. And in case it's hard to see, slide six highlights exactly where the Sophia button is. Slide seven is what you see when you click on that button. It's got sort of a almost a baseball card collection of stats. There's a page like this for all the missions that are kept at IPAC, or at IRSA, rather. But if you actually just want to load the tool, slide eight highlights what button to push. So if you go on that, slide nine is what you see when you start the Sophia Science Data Archive. The default search that you're dropped into is by position. But again, with an eye towards, just give me my data, what you want to do is instead, on slide 10, pick all sky. Then, if you look down further on that page, you'll see that there are some triangles. If you click on the triangle, it will reveal additional options. So you want to reveal the additional options for proposal constraints, and put in your PI's last name here. Partial matching works, so if you can't remember whether there is one S or two S in Anderson, if you just search on Anders, you will find both.
Excuse me,
Louisa,
I should have asked this a couple of slides ago when you were talking about proprietary. Is it clear what data is proprietary?
Absolutely. Next slide, I will show you exactly what that looks like.
Okay, great, because I'm interested in what data is proprietary and also why it's proprietary, because, you know, that would tell you when maybe it would become available. But okay, I'll let you get to that. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, just give me one more slide. So the last important part on slide 10 is the data product constraints. So level zero is the rawest level. And level four is the highest level, so like mosaics, right, as opposed to individual data frames. So you might want, as I did in this screenshot, just level three and level four data, not the lower level products. Not all instruments produce all levels, but level three and level four should get you most of the most interesting stuff. So then on slide 11, you see the results of the search that I just laid out on slide 10. So slide 11 has an AOR tab in the foreground on the left-hand side, and that is a list of all the AORs meeting the search criteria that you put in. So the red rows that appear right there, those are proprietary data. So you can tell at a glance then from your search results that there are some proprietary data in here. If you go to the next slide, slide 12, it highlights those specific red rows. And because in this screenshot I have not logged in, it does not give me access to those data. So slide 13, again, with a goal towards just give me all my data. If you just want to select all the data, you can click the tick box at the top of that leftmost column. If you just want individual observations, you can just click the individual tick box on the row of the observation that you want. But just to select all of them, click on the top. And then slide 14 shows that you want to next hit prepare download. What that does is start to bundle up the data that you've requested. Slide 15 shows you what happens. Since I have not logged in, it denies me access to the proprietary data. So only the data that I have access to will be downloaded. And then in order to start that bundling up process, you click on prepare download there. And then slide 16 shows that it's actually starting to do that bundling process. If you want to continue to search in the Sophia Science Archive while it's bundling stuff up for you, you can click on the send to background button and it will send that bundling process off into the background. Now, I asked for all the data here, which was a lot. So when it's done packaging, it gives me a long list of zip files to download. So if I just had one or two.
I have a question.
Yeah, what's that?
A really dumb, simple question. So logging in, how do you log in? Is the name sort of carried over from the old?
You should have, if you were a Sophia Observer before very recently, you should already have an account. You should have an email from either the URSA user support or the Sophia user support with all of the information, the username and the login information. Your username should be your email, but it may be the email that you have, you know, registered with Sophia. Does that answer your question?
Okay. Yes, it does. Thanks.
Okay. So when, in this case, in this example, I have lots and lots and lots of individual zip files, which, you know, if I only had one or two, it's easy to just click download and get those files. But on slide 18, if you would rather have it email when it's done and email you a script that you can run to go and pull all of these zip files and uncompress them, if you click on enable email notification and type in your email, it will do exactly that. Whenever it's done packaging, it will send you an email, and the email will have a list of links in it, and one of those links is get a script to download all of the pieces for the download.
I think you mentioned the proprietary data. It tells you if the proprietary data is not available. But let me re-ask the question I asked earlier. If there is proprietary data, is there a way to find out when it's not going to be proprietary? That is what it's sort of a teaser to say there's stuff I'm not letting you see, and I'm not even telling you when you are going to be able to see it.
So yes, so there is, because this is a screenshot, I can't dynamically do it and have you see me, see what I'm doing. But one of the we'll go through. I don't have a slide that specifically addresses that, but I do have slides that address how to get more details about the observation, and that includes the date at which it was taken, and it includes a link to the abstract for the proposal. So that information combined should be able to tell you when the data will be public.
Is that the case? I mean, how complicated are the rules about the how long data is proprietary?
So the Sophia Science Center sets that. I'm pretty sure that I have colleagues from URSA on the line. Does any of my colleagues on the line know the answer to that question off the top of their head?
Louisa, it's Bumina here. Can you repeat the question, please?
They want to know how, if you can figure out when the data will be public from the information that's in the archive.
Not today, but that update has already been made to include that information in the next release.
Oh, okay.
So there will be a column that says public date.
Oh, that's great. That answers my question. So you're saying it's not available now, but it will be. That's fine. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and it definitely has the date at which it was obtained. So whatever rules Sophia has, which I'm sorry, I don't know off the top of my head, but like with Spitzer, it was a year-long proprietary period, unless it was a director's discretionary time proposal, in which case, you know, or an exploration science proposal, in which case the rules were different. But you can at least see when the data were observed right now. Okay.
I can maybe add something. Yes, Nicola from Bordeaux. For the legacy programs, the rules are a little bit different. So the data become publicly available immediately after the delivery. But that's a special case.
Right. But, and those, since they'd be public, they wouldn't be read in the, right, they wouldn't be listed as proprietary.
Exactly. But I also have a small question, because when you search for data, and I just learned that there are going to be some changes made in the software. Do you also consider to change the way for searching, for example, for PIs? Because there is a problem that if there are several PIs, which can be the case for collaborate projects, then it doesn't find the right PI names. So, yeah.
Okay. So I am not sure. I am not sure about that. Let me make a note about multiple PI projects. Because I don't know. Vandana, do you know?
Right now, multiple PI projects are not listed as such in the archive. They're not delivered like that to us. So.
Yeah, for the moment, it's like that one PI name is mentioned. But if you search for the other PI, then you're lost. So that's right. For the legacy programs, and that's for other co-PI projects, because there are some German-American collaboration projects. That's right. Just a proposal that maybe for the next change of the software, this could be included then.
Okay.
I've added that would we are aware of this issue. The thing is, we cannot, at IRSA, we cannot make that change on our own. It requires more than one party to make that change. So, yes, we are aware of it.
Okay, good. Thanks. I don't want to continue anymore.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. So, all right. So I am looking at slide 19, which is the dividing line between the quick launch section, and now we'll go through some of the choices in more detail. So slide 20 talks about how there's basically three main phases to the process. There's the searching process, and there's many different ways to search. There's the exploring the results, and there's many different ways to do that, including getting previews of the data, and then the downloading phase, where you can change how files are packaged. For the rest of the slides, the important points are given in red, but hints and tips are in purple italics. So slide 21, this is, again, what you see when you are dropped into the Sophia Science Archive. And so I wanted to start specifically showing how you can get more help. So there's a help button in the upper left that will give you access to all of the online help for the archive. There is right under the main header a link to help notes. In other words, what data are available and what important caveats are present specifically for the instruments that have been ingested. And then the circle around the question mark gives you help very specifically to what you are doing. So it'll give you context-sensitive help. Slide 22, when you are first dropped into the Sophia Science Archive, the default is a single inertial position, by which I mean the target it is observing is not moving, that you can specify it with RANDEC or galactic coordinates, something. In other words, it's not a moving object. So below the box there, you can see that there's many different examples given of how you can specify targets. You can give it a name. You can give it coordinates in J2000 or B1950. You can give it in ecliptic coordinates or galactic coordinates. And as soon as you start typing in that box, that help changes to reflect what it is interpreting that you're entering. So if you go to slide 22, here I've put in M42. And it went and got the coordinates for M42 from NED. And it is echoing back to me in both decimal degrees and hours, minutes, seconds, degrees, minutes, seconds, what it thinks I want. And so this is a good way to check and make sure that it has understood you correctly. Then the next part on slide 24, you want to put in a search radius. Now, it may be that your instinct is to put in a number and then change the units. It turns out you need to change the units first and then put in the number. Because if you put in 100 arc minutes with the intention of changing that pull down from arc seconds to arc minutes, it will change, it will convert the number you've put in the box into units of arc minutes. So you need to pick the units first and then put in your search radius.
Quick question.
Slide. Yeah.
So on slide, well, the last couple of slides, I see it says try Ned, then Sinbad, but it looks like there's a menu of other choices.
Yes, you can take Sinbad.
What are some of the other?
Yeah, you can choose Sinbad's resolution, name resolution over Ned, because those are the two choices, try Ned, then Sinbad, or try Sinbad,
okay.
Then Ned. Yeah.
Okay.
Or you can put in the coordinates that you specifically want.
Okay.
Okay?
Let me break in, Louisa, and ask, I should have asked this a long time ago, but over on the left, where you got spatial constraints, object position seems to be pretty obvious. Multiple positions, I guess that's obvious. Solar system target, I don't understand why that's not an object. I mean, if I choose object,
because it's moving. Give me a couple slides. Slide 25.
Let me just go on, and then I have no idea what all sky means.
Yeah, give me a couple slides. I promise I will go through it.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, so slide 25 talks about the second choice, right? The multiple positions. So you can upload a list of targets. It needs to be an IPAC table format, which is just ASCII with a particular header. And if you get into the help, it'll give you examples. You can load your own list of targets from your disk, or there's a little bit of disk space at URSA that you can use if you want. It's called the URSA workspace. Again, you can find information, detailed information about that in help. So then, you, just like for an individual, a single object, you can put in the search radius here too. All right, so slide 26. Here is where we talk about the solar system targets. And the reason it matters is because these targets move with time. And so you have to search for them in a fundamentally different way. So the way that we search is shown in basically in slide 27. You need to type your target into the box. And just like for an inertial target, it will try and guess what it is that it thinks you mean. But you do have to really pay attention to this because there can be multiple NAIF IDs that correspond to the same object. And you need to make sure that you've picked exactly what it is that you want to pick. So you need to type in the box and then pick from the available choices. You can see in slide 27 that you've got a choice of two different possible definitions of Europa, but then also a spacecraft. So that hasn't even launched yet. So you need to make sure that you pick the right object. And then slide 28 shows what happens after I've picked the object that I want. And again, it's echoing below the box to make sure that it's understood me correctly. Now, pre-recovery is not available yet, but that will enable you to put in an orbit and figure out where there might be serendipitous coverage of your object. In other words, pre-discovery or pre-recovery. But that's not available in this version. It will be eventually. Then the last choice on slide 29 is the all-sky search. So probably the most common use of this option is going to be, like I showed in the very beginning, pulling all of the data associated with a particular PI or a particular program. But you can, for example, say, I want to search the entire archive of, say, forecast observations, right? So that you can use that all sky choice with additional constraints applied later on in the search page so that you can, for example, pull all of the forecast observations if that's what you want, or all of the forecast observations between a couple of dates if that's what you want. Does that answer your question, Dan?
Yeah, I think it does. And I guess once you check all sky, it looks like on slide 30, the next slide, that's where you go down to the constraints and say what you want to look at. Like
you can actually set those
data, or I just want to look at this PI's data.
Right.
Okay,
you can set all of those constraints even if you haven't chosen all sky, even if you want to search by object or position. You can say, I just want the forecast data from Orion, for example.
Okay, great.
So yeah, so slide 30 is saying, okay, let's start looking at these additional choices. The little black triangle on the left of each of those is what you want to click on to expand the choices. So slide 31 shows you what happens when you expand all of them. Proposal constraints can be like the PI or the plan ID. Slide 32 is observation constraints. So like searching on the mission ID, the AOR ID, or the date. And then slide 33 is searching on instruments. So the screenshot there is searching for any instrument, but over on the left-hand side, you can see a screenshot of the pull-down menu. So you can choose to search for just data from one instrument. And then the configuration and spectral element menus change depending on what instrument you pick, because not, you know, every instrument has a different configuration and choices. So those menus will change in response to what you pick for the instrument choice. And then slide 34 is the data product level. Like maybe you're interested in the rawest possible level, or maybe you're interested in just the most processed data. And then the observation type can be object, sky, dark, or flat.
So if you hit the little question mark at lower right in that box, is that going to explain what the levels actually mean?
Well, it describes it in global terms. It is slightly different in practice for each instrument.
Yeah.
So it does explain it in global terms. And if you go to the basically the first page of the help, it has a summary of, you know, data caveats, like which instruments are included and which instruments have which data levels if they don't have, like, for example, great data is only available in tarballs, and I think it only does to level 3. I don't think they have level 4. So there's information about that in the online help, but admittedly that's at the beginning of the online help as opposed to where it drops you when you click that little question mark. The little question mark there tells you globally level 0 is raw, level 4 is high level, and the observation types can be object, sky, dark, or flat.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
Okay, slide 35.
Louisa, I do think great has level 4.
Oh, okay. Okay. I admit that I lose track of those, but yes. Okay, so the results screen is slide 35. And you can see there's two main, they're called window panes. So the left side window pane is the search results, and the right side is details. So it gives you more information about whatever row you've selected on the left-hand side. If you would like those two different window panes to take up different screen real estate, you can click and drag the boundary between the panes to change the relative sizes of them. So slide 36 highlights the fact that this search that I did asked for all the instruments. So I have an AOR tab and then 7 other tabs, 1 per instrument that I requested. And on the right-hand side, it's got details in the foreground right now. But then there's also other tabs, which we'll explore momentarily, that say data and coverage. So that is going to provide you a different level of detail about the observation that's highlighted on the left. So the reason the AOR tab on slide 37 is in the foreground is that it's the most compact view of the observations. And you can scroll left and right within each of these tabs to see more of the column choices. Slide 38 talks specifically about the ways to control what you see in those tables, because all these tables are ubiquitous in these IRSA tools. So the first thing are the arrows and that allow you to page earlier or later in the pages of results. By default, it gives you 100 observations per page. Here I have only 82. So there's only one page of results for this search, but you can do a search that gives you many pages of results, in which case those arrows will help you navigate through that list of results. Then the next icon, the icon that looks like a funnel, is a filter so that you can, after the fact, search on, say, example, limiting it to only one instrument or limiting it to only moving targets or whatever constraints you want to put on it. The next button will change the view that you have from this interactive table to an ASCII table. The diskette allows you to save the table of results as an IPAC table file. The gears allow you to change the table options. So you can hide or reveal columns. You can change the number of results per page, or you can even impose filters from this interface. Then the arrows that are going to the upper left and the lower right make this window pane take up the whole browser window. And then there's the context sensitive help marker there too. So slide 39, now I've gone to the Xyz tab and the coverage tab. Slide 40 just reiterates that I've chosen one instrument tab and then the coverage tab on the right-hand side. So slide 41 is trying to explain a little bit more about what it is that you're looking at. So the coverage tab is giving you an image in the background, and that is data. It's a HIPS image. Now, if you've not heard of HIPS, HIPS is a dynamically changing resolution form. So in other words, it only loads the pixels, the lower resolution pixels that you need. If you zoom in, it will go and get higher resolution data. If you zoom out, it will, I mean, basically HIPS images cover the whole sky. So the key thing to remember is that HIPS images are really good for observing, for investigating big chunks of sky. If you would rather have a FITS image in the background, you can do that too. There's a list of tools at the top there that allow you to manipulate the image. You can zoom in, zoom out, measure things, add markers, add coordinates. You can even overlay a DSign regions file if that's what you'd like to do. So there's image tools that are at the top there. In this context, because I searched on M42, which is a really popular target, that layers icon is really important. So that layers icon is telling us that we have 8 layers on the image. And if you go to slide 42, that's what you get when you click on the layers icon. There's actually so many layers that I couldn't make it fit in one screenshot. You have to scroll up and down to see it. But you can see that it's overlaid polygons that are the footprints of all the observations that it found for FIFI-LS, Xyz Forecast, Hawk Plus, and Great. And each of those instruments is a different color. And if they're tiny observations, they're a different symbol as opposed to a polygon. So it may be that you would like to turn off some of these layers in order to make more sense of that coverage tab. Slide 43 is highlighting the fact that the table and the image are linked. So the row of the observations that I have highlighted in yellow there that I've clicked on the left corresponds to that heavy orange outlined footprint in the coverage image on the right. So if I were to pick a different row, then a different polygon would be highlighted in the right-hand side. And it works the other way, too. If you want to click on one of the bigger footprints to see which observation that corresponds to, it will jump in the list to that observation. So the whole point of this feature in slide 44 is to give you the ability to investigate the observations, because maybe there's stuff that you didn't know was there. Maybe you need to investigate whether or not the observation that it's retrieved really covered the specific region you cared about. Maybe there are other observations nearby with the same instrument or a different instrument that you didn't know existed. But yes, in a region where there are this many observations, like Orion, it can be overwhelming. So you may want to get really familiar with the layers pop up to turn off and on different footprints in order to sort out what's going on. The next slide, slide 45, has the search results for Betelgeuse. And I know that you guys have just released a call for proposals to analyze the Betelgeuse spectra. This is the set of Xyz observations of Betelgeuse. And so that's much less overwhelming than M42 because there's just a few of the observations. Okay, slide 46. So on slide 46, I've selected the forecast tab on the left and now the data tab on the right. So in this case, I am viewing the FITS file that corresponds to that observation that I've selected on the left. It's not a JPEG or a PNG. It's the actual FITS file. So on slide 47, I wanted to highlight the fact that you can use those image tools to manipulate the image. You can zoom in and out, change the color stretch or the color table. You can measure distances. You can select regions and do statistics on those regions. You can add coordinates. You can overlay DS9 regions files, all sorts of powerful things. And this particular image has multiple planes in the FITS file, so you can scroll among the planes of data in the FITS file. So slide 48 is showing some of the spectroscopy results. So now I'm looking at the XEs tab and the data tab. The particular observation that I picked is still an image, so you can see the spectrum in the image. The tool will be able to display extracted spectra in the future, but right now even the extracted spectra are shown as images. Slide 49 starts the steps to download. So once you've found data that you want to download, you select the tick box on the left. And again, just to remind you, if you just want to select all the data, you just click on the tick box on the top of the column. And then slide 50, you click on prepare download. Now slide 51 talks about the choices you have for preparing the download. So you get a pop-up that first says title. That title just refers to how this packaging process is tracked through the background monitor. It doesn't matter so much for small downloads, but if you're doing lots of big downloads, gosh, it's nice to be able to keep this separately so that you can put in, you know, a date and a time or a target or whatever you need to help you keep track of which packaging job is which. The zip file structure basically is just talking about whether or not there's going to be a lot of directories and subdirectories or whether it's going to be a flat file structure. The save as name is the file name it's going to use when it saves to your disk, and you can save to your disk or the IRSA workspace if you would rather. It's going to save the files wherever your browser is configured to save files. It might be in a downloads folder, it might not, it depends on how you've configured your browser. And then again, if you're packaging lots and lots of things, if you turn on email notification, it will most importantly let you know when it is done so that you don't have to keep an eye on it. It will just tell you when it's done. But also importantly, it will send you an email that has a script so that you can download all the pieces with a single command line invocation. And again, that matters a lot more when you have big downloads. Your computer should automatically know what to do with zip files. It might uncompress them for you. If you are working from the command line and you have many zip files, turns out unzip *.zip does not work. You need to do unzip and then escape the wildcard with the backslash to unzip all of the zip files at once. And then just to remind you on slide 52, those red rows mean proprietary data, so you can't even preview those data unless you've logged in and have access to those observations. So slide 53 just has some more advanced tips and tricks. There are some important caveats in the online help, like, for example, some columns aren't populated. So, for example, things that aren't moving targets don't have a NAIF ID, and so you end up with a column that seems weird because it's totally empty, but that's because your search results only gave you inertial targets, not moving targets. Some calibration observations or products of many combined observations often don't have a PI at all. Some files don't appear or won't be able to be visualized. So we were talking briefly about this earlier. All data files are not found in all instruments, and extracted spectra can be rendered as images at the moment. And for example, grate level 3 and 4 are tar files, and so they cannot be visualized using the image viewer that's part of the tool. And also, if you're doing lots and lots of subsequent searches, everything on the search page is ANDed together. So you might be doing a search on, say, M42 data obtained between two dates and then some other parameters. And then when you go back, you want to search on a completely different target, say the Lagoon Nebula, and you might forget that you've actually put a date constraint on it. But unless you clear out that date constraint, it's going to get ANDed in to the rest of the parameters that you put on the search page. So if you're doing lots and lots of searches at once, like ahem, if you're testing the archive, you might trip over that because all of those parameters are ANDed together when you do the search. Slide 54 is talking specifically about filtering columns. And I have a couple slides just on column filtering because it is very, very powerful for weeding down the lists of results. So slide 55 is the search I'm about to do. So it's M42, but now I'm asking for all levels of data. So slide 56 is the search results just for forecast. And I've got 1,500 results from forecast. And so the coverage there, all those footprints get really complicated. But I'm going to click on the filter button, the one that's circled in red there. And if you go to slide 57, you can see that the filter has now added a box and sometimes an arrow at the top of every column. And because the processing level column has a finite number of choices, the filtering pull down tells you, okay, which one of these do you want to filter on? Do you want just level 3 or level 2 and level 3? And then once you've picked what you want, you explicitly click filter once you've finished clicking all of the things that you want it to search on, or you can clear the search. So now here I've got only 41 observations once I've filtered it down to just level 3 on slide 58. And then you can see that I now have two choices. I have an icon that tells me that there's one filter applied to the data, or I have a cancel filters choice where I can cancel all the filters I've imposed at once. So slide 59 is imposing a filter on the XSEES data to ask only for observation type object. And then slide 60 is a more sophisticated combination of filters. So if I look in the forecast results and tell it I only want imaging data, not GRISM data, and then I add an additional constraint on the spectral resolution column to ask it for a resolution greater than 20, that is going to filter down my results to be just the narrow band images from forecast.
Louisa, I'm looking at slide 60 where you have the two tables, the table on the left, the table on the right. And the table on the left is sort of what we were seeing before, where, you know, you get the AOR and the instrument and the target. But on the right, there's all sorts of extra information, which is really important.
Yeah, and so this is one of the hiccups that comes from the fact that I had to do static screenshots for this.
No, okay. So, but for each AOR, you not only have an instrument and a target, you have all sorts of things. You have spectral filter, you have the aperture, you have the spatial offset. Where is all that stuff?
So if you look on slide 60, this is actually two different views of the same table. I don't know if you can see or recognize that this is, there's a scroll bar in the bottom of the screenshot on the left.
Yes. Okay.
So there's many columns, and you can scroll back and forth, and using the gears, if you don't want some of those columns to appear, you can turn them off. If you do want some columns to appear, you can make sure they're turned on. So there are many columns available, and you can impose filters on multiple columns at once, and they get ANDed together. So that, like in this example, you can say, I just want the imaging with the spectral resolution greater than 20. Okay. Does that answer your question?
That I think that's sort of 90% of the answer. I guess I mentioned the spatial offset. You know, your target, you have a target. You say, okay, I'm looking at BN, but this observation is 10 arc seconds east of BN. Where is that 10 arc seconds east?
That is a good question. It may be that information must be in there because we have the footprint of the observation.
Sure.
Vandana, do you know if that's a column in the results or that's something you'd have to get from the visualization of the footprint?
I guess, you know, you could just have that appear under target. You say the target is 10 arc seconds east of VN.
Yeah, it might need to explicitly say that, but not every instrument, not every observer populates that field in the same way.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Well, I guess.
Because there are some calibration observations that show up as Jupiter, even though they're not looking at Jupiter. It's because they were looking at Jupiter recently to that calibration observation. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Okay, so if you're looking at different spatial offsets around given targets, life gets a little complicated looking at the AOR.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, so you may have to go into the individual observation, and you may need to work interactively with the coverage to try to see exactly where the footprint is. And then, of course, you can also preview the data to see exactly what it is that it's got in the FITS file.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
Okay, so we are running out of time, but we are also near the end of the stack. So slide 61 is just talking about how SOFIA fits in context with the rest of the tools at IRSA. So one of the main advantages to having the SOFIA archive at IRSA is now those data are all integrated with a lot of the other IRSA tools and data, and they're going to become even more integrated in the future. So you can access other images and catalogs at IRSA or worldwide, but with the same tool. So slide 62 shows that on the IRSA front page, there's a data discovery box that basically just says, tell me everything you can find at IRSA overlapping this position. So it's just saying, give me everything you got, images, catalogs, anything that's close. The IRSA Viewer icon is a tool. So IRSA Viewer is sort of the most generic version of this tool that is the guts of SOFIA. So it's the same kind of look and feel, but allows you to easily compare data from multiple observatories. So slide 63 is what you see if you click on IRSA Viewer. And the first thing you need to tell it is what kind of image you want, whether that's FITS images or a three-color composite made from FITS images or a HIPS image. Remember, HIPS images cover the whole sky, and they're dynamically adjusted resolutions. So that's really good if you want to visualize a huge chunk of sky. Like, I study star formation, so I might want to get, to interact with a portion of the sky that's, say, the Perseus star-forming region, which is enormous, right? So the HIPS image would definitely be the right choice for that kind of exploration. Then you need to say where your image source is coming from, whether it's from IRSA Tools or from My Disk or from the web or from the IRSA workspace. Then you need to put in the position just like you do with SOFIA, and again, tell it the size that you want. And then the bottom of this IRSA Viewer search page has a very, very long list of data deliveries, and it's growing all the time. So if it's the very first time you've accessed this tool, it can be overwhelming to see how many choices you have. Those filters on the left are invaluable so that you can, for example, filter down to just BWISE data or just TUMAS data. Or if you scroll down further, you can choose just galactic programs. So it will help make that very long list slightly more manageable. So slide 64 is what's happened where I have asked it for images of M16, the Eagle Nebula, 500 arc seconds chunk of sky, and I have asked it for GLIMPSE data. So GLIMPSE was a galactic plane survey conducted by Spitzer. And then you can't see on this screenshot, but I have also told it to give me WISE data from one of the WISE releases. So slide 65 is the initial results from that search. So it's the same size patch of sky, but you can see right away they're not oriented the same way. That's because the GLIMPSE team generated their image tiles in galactic coordinates rather than RA and DEC. So on slide 66, I have explicitly told it, lock all the images together and put north up. Those are the red circled icons there. And you can see that now things are oriented the same in all of the images. Slide 67, because these are the FITS images, you can change the color stretch and the color table. I've changed it to reverse grayscale, and it changes all of them at once. And I can overlay markers. So I can overlay footprints from the various SOFIA instruments, but also other instruments like HST or JWST. So there's several different observatory footprints available for overlay. This is the marker icon that's circled in red on the right. That allows you to put a generic marker on the image or footprints from any of a variety of observatories. And then slide 68 is even more sophisticated. So I've taken that M16 search, and I have also asked it for a catalog from TUMAS over this whole region. And then I filtered down, so the catalogs tab is at the top. That's how I got access to a catalog search. And then the right-hand side is the TUMAS catalog that it retrieved. But you can see that I've set three filters. I've told it only show me data that have a signal-to-noise ratio greater than 10 in JH and K. And then in the bottom, I've made a plot from that catalog. I've made a plot of J minus H versus H minus K. By default, the plot comes up with RA and DEC, but you can change what's plotted and you can do simple manipulations like subtract this column from that column and plot it. And then I have overlaid that catalog on the image, and I'm showing only one image at a time, the all Y's W3, Y's 3, so image that's there. And so all of these are interactive. So once I filter down the catalog, then it shows only those filtered down sources on the image and in the plot. And I can click on a point in the plot and be taken to where in the catalog that source is and where on the image that source is. So they're all interlinked. I can click on an individual source in the image, and it will jump in the catalog and show you where it is in the plot. So it's all interactive. So in order, the very last slide, slide 69, is where to get more help. So there are help buttons in all of these tools that will get you the online help. It's also available as a PDF, which you can then search. There's context-sensitive help markers all over these archives, and it should drop you into the relevant portion of the online help. There's the IRSA help desk, which is linked from the main IRSA front page. There's also an IRSA YouTube channel where I have lots and lots and lots of short videos, handful of long videos, but mostly very short videos saying, okay, here we're going to explore just the image toolbar, for example, or this is how plots work, or, you know, very specific targeted things. And then I have it organized by playlists so that the playlists, there is one playlist that collects all of the Sophia videos in one place. So it's not meant to be like sit down and watch the whole playlist from start to finish. It's more like, here's a playlist to use as a table of contents from which you can select, oh, I'd like to learn more about proprietary data, or I'd like to learn more about catalogs, or, you know, very specific Sophia-relevant videos all pulled together. And then the screen capture video that I made of this talk is also in that Sophia playlist. And so there's also other tutorials that are you know, like all of the WISE tutorials are collected in a WISE playlist. All of the tutorials relevant to solar system observers for all the tools at IPAC are collected, or at IRSA, are collected in one playlist. So I'm going to leave, so I'm going to just leave it there and take any additional questions we have in the time that we have remaining.
Louisa, thank you. This is really great. It's really an impressive piece of work. We've got time for questions. So let's do that right now. I'll start out with one, Louisa, and this may be a question as much for Sophia staff as for you, but I'm wondering about the schedule for posting in IRSA. How fast does the data get from the observatory to IRSA?
Vandana, you may need to take that one.
Okay, and you know, you could say, okay, well, there's no reason for it to get posted before the proprietary period elapses. But another thing you could say, just strategically, is that, gee, it might be nice to know if some observations were taken of this object at this wavelength in this way, even if I can't see the data for a couple of months.
Right.
And I can look forward to that. So I guess I'd just like to understand what the how does the scheduling work for this stuff getting to IRSA?
Well, I can take that, Louisa, if you want. What happens is the data gets taken, and then it goes to the Sophia Science Center, and they do some processing, and then some of it, like if it's great, I believe it gets processed, by the great team. And then, and then it gets delivered, you know, there's some time lapse while that is all happening, which is measured in probably weeks. And then it gets delivered to IRSA, and as soon as we get it, we press the ingest button and it gets put into the operational archive. And even if it's proprietary data, it still shows up in the archive. You just can't access it if you don't have the proprietary credentials. So it's pretty much as soon as we get it is when it's made available.
Okay, but it sounds like you're saying that it gets to IRSA and is posted on IRSA within, let's say, a couple of months after
it's... No, days. Days after we get it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but,
It stays after we get it, but it could be longer from when it was observed.
Yeah, right. So this is Ed Chambers from the Sophia Science Center. So the normal processing is we take the data, we run it through our pipeline, and we have the normal period of 15 days for our facility instruments or longer for the PI instruments to get the data into the archive, and that's what we've always done. So what we do now is we still put it in our local DCS archive, and as soon as we do that, then we make the transfer down to IRSA, and within 24 hours, it's been available at IRSA. So it's usually for the facility instruments, our users shouldn't see any, or for all the instruments, our users shouldn't see any delay because of the IRSA transition. It'll be available at the same time to them. It's always been available. It's just through the new interface.
Okay, that's really interesting. And again, getting back to my strategic point, when it lands in IRSA before the proprietary is lapsed, a user can get into IRSA and see exactly what data was taken, but just not see the data. Is that
right?
The way?
Yeah. Yep. Okay. That's exactly how it works. Yep. Remember the red rows that I was highlighting?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, thank you. That's really interesting. Okay, other questions for Louisa?
Yeah.
This is Ariel from the Sophia Science Center. Thank you for the talk. On slide 62, you present the data discovery feature.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I missed that, but Sophia is still not available.
Yep, we're working on it. Working on it. So the Sophia data don't show up there yet, but they will.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a question about programmatic access to the archive. In particular, I'm curious about AstroQuery, or are there any other options? I see there is a VO API, but I'm interested in AstroQuery, for example.
Vandana, do you want to take that?
Yes. We have a plan to make sure that Sophia data are available through VO protocols. They are not currently, and there's a technical reason for that we are working on, but I won't go into it. But there is, we are aware of AstroQuery, and actually IRSA is, AstroQuery was originally written by IRSA users, you know, as an open source thing, and people just thought, oh, we would like to have this, and so they created it. And so recently, we have decided that we will take a more active role in contributing to AstroQuery to make sure that it's keeping up with our VO queries that we're making available. So it will be available at some point. I can't give you the schedule right now, through AstroQuery and or PyVO. So there are two related Python libraries where we will start making VO access to IRSA datasets more complete. And Sophia will definitely be a part of that. And we will let everybody know as soon as that becomes more mature. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Other questions for Louisa?
Hi. I'm a little bit new to this, but I had a question. Does Sophia Archive contain fully reduced data sets provided by the original observers?
It depends on what the Sophia Science Center gives us, right?
Okay.
Well, we could take contributed data sets. So if I understood your question correctly, if the original observers have some program and they, you know, do extra analysis with, you know, added value to it, then IRSA can accept contributed data sets by the PIs to make that value-added data available to the public. This is something that we've done a lot for Spitzer and Herschel, and they have different names. I think for Spitzer, it was like Legacy and Exploration Science.
Yeah,
and for Herschel, it was Key Programs. But we don't only take contributed data from, you know, the official large programs or whatever. Our criteria are, it has to have some relationship to a NASA data set, which Sophia is, and it has to have a refereed publication associated with it. And then we have to have time, because we fit it in, you know, we can't slow down Sophia ingestion or NeoWise release or anything. So we fit it in between those other big releases. But you just have to
contact the IRSA help desk if you have something like that, and we can talk about it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, we just have a couple of minutes left in the hour, but if anybody has one more quick question, we can probably do that. Okay, let's
see. You can also send questions to the help desk or, you know, even social media if that's what you'd prefer.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, so thank you very much, Louisa. This is great.
No problem.